say you're teaching a lesson and you're about halfway through it. So you ask a question, and it's a pretty challenging question, but it has one single correct answer. Still, you get a few hands to shoot up, a couple of them, and you call on a student and they give you the correct answer. And you are psyched, a little bit inside psyched, because that means they're not just doodling, they're not totally daydreaming, somebody's following you. And so if you're me, you're doing like an outward physical happy dance, showing them your jubilation. But maybe you're a little bit more quiet type. Anyway, after your moment of celebration, you follow that series with why. Why did you do that? Why is it there? And you wait. And you wait. And you wait. Good thing wait time's not a problem for you, but the silence becomes deafening. And now you're watching, and the eyes are no longer locked up here. They're all around the room. These students are just hoping and praying you don't call on them. Does this sound like something that's happened in your classroom? If so, hit that like button now. Then keep listening as I discuss higher order questioning, why it's a perfect partner for our science classrooms, and what we can do to plan for it in a way that actually works when we're prepping our lessons. I'm Lisa from Lab in Every Lesson, and I want you to ditch your lecture notes in favor of active learning strategies. On this channel, I talk all about student-centered classrooms, inquiry and discovery, things you can actually do in your classroom to get you one step closer to actually imparting real life skills to your science students. Each year in my school, it seems like we have a different focused initiative for the teaching staff to focus on when they're planning, prepping, delivering their lessons. And several years ago, long before I started implementing this active learning strategy and philosophy in my classroom, I had an assistant principal who would observe me and evaluate me and give me feedback. And she was always asking me the same thing. She was always saying, "Lisa, how could you go deeper on this concept? How could you get students to think more deeply about it?" And I just want to say, I loved this boss. She was an excellent supervisor in the respect that I really felt supported by her. I really felt that she pushed me to be my very best, which was going to eventually help the students be their very best. So let's not get any lines crossed here. I loved her, and I loved that she asked me these questions. But I hated that particular question because I never had an answer. And I am the person who likes to please. I like to meet the expectations. I like to do what I'm supposed to be doing. I like to be purpose driven, but I just didn't know how. And she didn't know my content. She wasn't a science teacher at all. But as an education leader, she was, you know, prompting me to do more. She just wanted to see and hear evidence of critical thinking in my classroom among my students. But I was clueless. If you feel like I just described the same conversation you've had with a principal or an instructional coach, you know you're supposed to be doing these things and you want to do these things, but you don't know how to do these things in a meaningful or successful way, go ahead in the comments below and type the word clueless. I think you'll be surprised to see just how many teachers are feeling the exact same way. So let's start with what higher order thinking and questioning even is. It really probably started as a means for us to assess or diagnose the degree to which a student understands something. Maybe we can think of it as their mastery within a content. For me, I think of it as complexity with a task, because my lessons are so task-driven, and when I design them, I am asking students to do more than just identify things and make lists and match components and things like that. So complexity of a task and critical thinking, for me, they go together. But you might think, if you heavily rely on lecture, you might think of it as mastery. How well has the student mastered this? Which, if you are leaning on lecture, unfortunately, that means how well has a student memorized this. regardless if you think of it as mastery or complexity, another word that might pop up is rigor. And that's a very popular word. It's a buzzword in education. Rigor, used to develop grit in our students. So let's focus on rigor for a minute. There was a book written called Rigor is Not a Four-Letter Word. And the author's name is Barbara Blackburn. In that article, she outlined for them 5 myths about rigor. Let's take a look at them. Myth number 1, lots of homework is a sign of rigor. Myth number 2, rigor means doing more. Myth number 3, rigor is not for everyone. Myth number 4, providing support means lessening rigor. And myth number 5, resources do not equal rigor. So maybe in defining higher order thinking, critical thinking, complexity, mastery, rigor, we've done better to say what it's not. It can commonly be confused with any action, but that's not what it is at all. In fact, most of us in our college career preparation programs, our certification programs, whatever you did to become a teacher, you learned about a few different frameworks that were built to help us understand rigor, mastery, complexity. The first of those that everybody has probably been introduced to absolutely is Bloom's taxonomy. It's probably the most easily recognizable, and how I like to break down Bloom's is we expect students first to know, then to do, and then to think it through. So of course Bloom's has this very, it's a little bit more detailed than that, as you can see here. Remember, understand, apply, analyze, evaluate, create, and it's changed over time. So if you're watching this and you're like, whoa there, this has been discounted and a whole bunch of holes poked through this. Yes, I know. It's still a basic framework, and it still illustrates the idea. And then we have Webb's depth of knowledge. Now, I became very familiar with Webb's depth of knowledge only in on-the-job work, because there was a year, as I told you, where all of our staff was really encouraged to access this higher order thinking. And so what Webb's depth of knowledge does is it provides us a link to verbs that describe basically those different levels of complexity or mastery or rigor. Simplistic activities, surface level activities, and then ones that require more connection. That's definitely a way we can think about this. So let's think about how this is typically achieved in a lecture lab environment. So in the status quo science classroom, where your students are taking notes 4 or 5 days out of a 6-day cycle, maybe, and on that 6th day, they're doing lab. In that environment, most of the time, we are focused on that know level. We're imparting all of our information to them. We're simply like trying to transfer it into their brains, which is not a thing. That's not how brains work, but we try to do it anyway. And then when we are doing some formative assessment, or maybe we're giving a homework or part of our test, is like low-level questioning. It involves students doing things like identifying and matching maybe terms and definitions, or drawing models and the organization of system of parts within a system. If we reference the story at the opening of this video, these are the questions our students are eager to raise their hands, stick their neck out, and provide an answer, because a lot of times these are like one word answers. There are simple classifications or simple definitions, and they're easy to retrieve through memory. Then later on in the lesson, after maybe you've modeled a scenario or a system, or maybe while students are in the lab, now we're asking them to do something with that base knowledge that we have thought we provided them. In the lab, this looks like students doing things such as classifying, comparing, graphing, interpreting, or summarizing. They're making connections. They're starting to make connections between what they're supposed to know and how it actually works. Now, I'm speaking here specifically to science and our lab environment. It's very typical that before we go into the lab, or when we're finished with the lab, we're expecting students to be able to do the think it through part. The verbs, the actions we want them to do, the critical thinking that's necessary there is hypothesizing, is citing evidence from maybe their observations, is comparing what they found, and finally, concluding. So this is really the level, I think, at which in our story before, we're asking why. So we're in the middle of our lecture. The students haven't experienced at all yet, and we're saying, why? And we're surprised that no one's answering or no one's confident in answering. Because the do part is so separate and it's so infrequent, and the students can't make those connections with lecture alone. Now, the highest level of these taxonomies, both of them, is really what we're focused on in the modern day movement towards STEM and STEAM, which includes that big letter E, engineering. Engineering is all about creating. Whether you're creating an adaptation of something that already exists to make it better, or you're creating something to solve a brand new problem, to apply the knowledge you've gained and the connections you've observed or made along the way, and then you know the answer to why it all happens, you can assemble all that to do something with it in a big way, to create not just new knowledge, but a new object. With that refresher on what higher order is, what mastery, complexity, rigor, what all that represents, now we can talk about why it's the perfect partner for science. If you've ever wondered what's back here behind me in my background, it is basically it's the scientific method I go after in most of my lessons, and ideally at the end of the year, every student has been able to achieve. And in fact, they are badges that I give out to students when they show these amazing behaviors. They include making outstanding observations, asking quality questions, citing evidence from what they've obtained in the way of observations, and then doing great analysis work. Making inferences, guesses, whether it's at the beginning of the process or the end of the process as part of concluding. And then finally, their work communicating that, writing it out or sharing with a team member and working it all out as part of a teamwork, team member situation. I want you to think about all those things for a minute. Observing and asking questions, making guesses and thinking it through, analysis, using what you've gained as, you know, taken in from the world to come to a conclusion, maybe with another person, or at least sharing with another person what you found. This describes the problem-solving process in all of life. All of life. And so I say science is a life skill. And so wonderful that we are the ones best able to prepare our students for encountering situations that will cause them uncertainty, giving them some security that they have a path forward. I believe it's the best preparation for problem solving. I also believe that it's a taxonomy in and of itself. It's a progression of learning. So if we go back to our lecture style lesson and realize that we're asking students why, really what we're telling them without so many words is there is one correct answer. When in fact, if we were to really go through the problem-solving process to determine why for ourselves, we might come up with a few different alternatives. When students are only led through lecture, when they don't have a subject or a muse to observe, to compare, to critique, to go through that inference and analysis and collection process, they have no choice but to just believe us. And I mean, I think this is made wholly evident when students fudge their data in a real life lab. I'm sure you've seen this. They know what they're supposed to get, maybe when they graph their data, or they know the color change that was supposed to happen because it happened over here for five other groups, but they didn't see the color change. Instead of just saying that they saw it become brown instead of blue, they'll say, oh, it became blue. Or they were supposed to get a straight line with their data, and in fact, they got this like really wavy, curvy thing. They try to make the data fit. I even see this in my classes 3/4 of the way through the year I am right now, and they're still trying to fit something that they didn't collect because they have conditioned themselves from, I'm gonna say, sorry, middle school teachers, but it happens there. In Pennsylvania, anyway, that's when we start heavily testing science on our standardized tests. And that's when instruction becomes so much about facts, so much about what you need to know and do, and so much about teaching to the test. All of the natural curiosity kind of goes out the window, and all the authentic idea brainstorming that happens and is so critical to problem solving in the future. Why is this happening? Let me come up with some ideas. It's gone. And this is why I've completely embraced discovery as a mechanism to teach the core ideas in my classroom. This is how I think we make higher order questioning and critical thinking skills work in our science classrooms. During class, every day, in this discovery inquiry-based type model, I am requiring students to work at that highest level of the taxonomy, to think it through as they uncover, discover, reveal the basic facts they need to know. So when my students are in the phase of observation, this is really what I think of as a DOK1 level of the lesson in my classroom, because everyone can observe. Everyone can write down what they see or hear. Now, because I teach in an online classroom, we are limited. We don't have the feel component, but I'd say most of our observations are made eyes and ears. Especially in chemistry, we shouldn't be tasting anything. But one thing that is a feeler, an experience feeler that my students need to do that they can't do, is definitely feel heat and feel the generation of warm or cold. So there definitely are some observations that I am limited to there. But I think we cover a good gamut with the eyes and the ears alone. Then after they've collected their observations, or while they're collecting their observations, they're doing that DOK level two. They're doing the verbs that are causing them to question the outcomes. They're maybe seeing something they didn't anticipate, or maybe as they are working through a simulation or watching a video, they've seen enough iterations to be able to predict what's going to happen next. When they're done collecting their observations, and they've had that experience, now they are reviewing the outcomes and they're thinking it through. They're at that DOK level three, where they're beginning to make connections and formulate concrete ideas. This is the level where maybe, even though every student sees and hears the exact same imagery, movement, sounds, they're all interpreting them maybe differently. I mean, the ultimate goal, my job as a teacher, is that they are seeing mostly the same thing. But magical things happen when students express themselves in their ideas, and they are just a tad bit different. And some pick up on minutiae, and others are kind of just still looking at the subtle features or the surface features of a task or an object or a system. And then usually in my classroom, the making inferences, the making conclusions, I can only be sure that's happening once we all come back together. I give every student an opportunity to think through them beforehand, but definitely it's the part of the process that bookends all of it, that answers the question, that reveals those core ideas, and it is something every student needs to have. So if they weren't able to get there themselves, this is the point at which they go, aha, this is how I connect the dots. So there is some modeling there for them. But definitely the anticipation is that if you can do this with consistency, that highest level task, making it all come together and confidently concluding an idea or confirming an idea, it's going to be conditioned. It's going to be something we can condition in them and eventually get to by the end of the year. In that article I cited earlier from Education Week, edweek.org, Barbara Blackburn outlined three overarching kind of umbrella things we can do to create a climate of rigor in our classrooms. They include demonstrating high expectations, providing support for our students, and asking them to show us what they understand. Using carefully designed, inquiry-based, and I choose inquiry because it can be easily adapted and modified for more or less guidance, but using these carefully designed learning activities, I can do all of those things in my classroom every day. And you can too. If you think you're ready to empower and free your students, to let them stretch and strengthen those problem-solving muscles, to stop trying to answer that huge, big, heavy, generic question, why? Head on over to labineverylesson.com/activeplan. There you can learn all about this amazing bundle of training videos and tools I've assembled for you to create your very first inquiry-based, technology-driven activity. And these activities can be built and rebuilt and rebuilt in a way so that you can deliver them each and every day for all the different content. I designed it to be not just another tool in your teacher toolbox, but a power tool in that teacher toolbox. One that makes your job easier and more pleasurable. That's what we need, right? Better outcomes and less stress. I'll see you back here soon.